Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. And before we get to Alan Bestwick, time now for our play-by-play call of the day, courtesy of KMOX, the legendary Mike Shannon. Randall Grichuk ends it.
Fly ball, deep to right field. Get up, baby. Get up. Get up. Get up. Good night, folks. He's just sent us home. A home run over the right field. A wall by Randall Grichuk, and the Cardinals win this one 4-3. Look at this group at home plate.
I always struggle to know which team he's broadcasting for. No, I'm just kidding. Mike was a great player for them. Played in the 67 World Series, in fact, when they won it at third base. Very pleased to bring in, just fresh off the golf course, I might add. Yeah. A guy that does an outstanding job for ABC. In fact, did an outstanding job in the Taxslayer Bowl, Penn State fans will know. That's Alan Bestwick. Alan, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Hey, Steve, pleasure. And yes, guilty as charged.
Did you play Brickyard Crossing, or where'd you play?
Brickyard Crossing's tomorrow. We actually were privileged enough to get on Crooked Stick today. And
ooh.
Yeah, it was terrific. The weather's terrific, and it was a great thing, great opportunity. That today the track is quiet, and all the drivers are out in all the big cities doing their media tours. So we had a little break after a couple of straight weeks of every day at the track, and it was nice to go tee it up.
Oh, that, absolutely. By the way, for those you hear Crooked Stick, that's where John Daly won his PGA. So
yeah,
all right, yeah, Alan. I wanted the James Hinchcliffe story. A year ago, he was on the verge of death at this place. And that's not an exaggeration. What did it take for him to come back to get to this point where he's on the pole?
Well, it took a couple of things. First of all, it took an incredible, amazing effort by the Speedway safety team and the trauma surgeons who saved his life a year ago. Second, it took a very determined effort on his part to rehab from these very severe injuries. I mean, he had a piece of the race car that was driven back through the car so hard that it went through him, literally. Picture like an arrow being shot through you. That's what happened to him, but it was a lot bigger than an arrow. And so you think about the physical injuries alone being enough to perhaps derail a career. Now it's time to get back in a race car. Most of us would think, when we've nearly lost our life at something, is that something I really want to do again? And for James, there was never any question. Literally, the third question he asked when he woke up in the hospital room was, when can I get back in the car? And he followed through on it. He last September did a test at Road America up in Wisconsin, got behind the wheel for the first time in an Indy car, and was nervous. First time he went out, after that, said, I got it. This is going to be fine. This spring, went to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to do a test on the oval. You would think driving through that corner for the first time and not lifting your foot off the gas would be quite a challenge. Did it, and from there, has been fine. So for all that he's been through, to see him get that reward is so wonderful. He's such a good guy. I mean, he is such a good guy. And it's a really great story to see, with another chapter yet to go.
And it's not Ganassi, and it's not Penske on the pole. It happens to be a Sam Schmitz team that's on the pole. What kind of story is that? This kind of engine can get out there and do the job it did with that kind of team.
Well, there's two angles to that story, Steve. First, there's Sam himself, who was a successful IndyCar driver who was paralyzed, became a quadriplegic in a racing crash in an IndyCar, and yet his passion for the sport is so great. He's a successful businessman, but he also wanted to build a race team, and he's done so. It's not the biggest team. They've got about 50 people compared to, a couple of hundred for some of the other teams. They field two race cars normally. There's a third one here at Indianapolis, where some of the other teams field four and sometimes a fifth one here at Indy. But they're competitive. And so for Sam to be an owner that has a chance to win the Indianapolis 500 is amazing. For his little race team to have a car that's on the pole for the 500 and a chance to win it is amazing also. So this whole thing is kind of like, I work for Disney. I've got to call it a Cinderella story. They're hoping that the clock doesn't strike midnight before the checkered flag falls Sunday.
For a long time, Joseph Newgarden's out of Nashville stood there and took the last guy to finally beat him. But Newgarden and Ryan Hunter-Reay are on the front row. What does it mean to IndyCar racing that two Americans are right there to at least start out? Does that have a significance for the popularity of IndyCar racing?
Well, I think it does, Steve, because one of the things that you've heard from fans, as you know, the folks in IndyCar have studied their audience and tell us what you think and so on, is that you know, a lot of drivers from overseas and not a lot of American drivers. And the significance is there are some up-and-coming American drivers, like Newgarden, who's from Nashville, right? That's NASCAR country. How did this kid from Nashville not wind up in NASCAR when he went racing? But he wanted to drive Indy cars, and here he is on the front row for the Indy 500, got a good car, got a good team, got a good chance to win it. Hunter Reay from Florida. He's been around a good bit longer. He's won the 500 before, and you know, when he stood there in victory lane 2 years ago at Indianapolis, had an American flag wrapped around his shoulders and said, "I'm a proud American boy." So I think it is significant. These are homegrown people, and racing fans. I think it gives them a reason to cheer for them. It's a reason to pull for these guys, and so that's important when you're trying to attract fans and give them a reason to care.
I realize a qualifying setup is different than a race setup, but I know they're all in the top nine on Sunday, but were you surprised the Penske cars did not make a better run at the pole?
I wasn't surprised on Sunday, but I was surprised all last week as the practice unfolded. You know, when practice is going on at a racetrack, you never know who's on what tires and what they're trying to do and what kind of, where IndyCar is concerned, what trim they've got on the car and what they're working on. But if you add it up cumulatively over a week and just look through all the speed charts from all the day's practices, the story that you got was that Chevrolet was not as fast as Honda this year, where a year ago it was reversed. And that Penske and Ganassi, the two powerhouse teams, if you will, that are Chevrolet teams, were struggling to find the speed to match the Hondas this time around. It's a story as old as racing, right? One brand finds something and steps ahead. The other brand catches up, maybe steps ahead of them. This time around, it appears Honda has an edge in the horsepower department. And so that's why Penske is not at the top of the speed chart. Race trim is another whole story. So much goes into winning the race. Roger Penske's team, Chip Ganassi's team, have so much experience and such good people managing that could be their equalizer.
Right, and that's, again, there's a different setup race day compared to qualifying day. Yet, I saw Munoz at one point cranked out on the straightaway, if I recall correctly, about 240. Is that what makes the sport, I mean, exciting? I'll back up on that for a second. The Pocono people will tell you, because they'll have two NASCAR races, and you're obviously exponentially familiar with what NASCAR does for obvious reasons, but they were taken aback when Indy came there and said, "I can't believe how fast these guys are." I don't think the people realize the difference in speed between the cars you're about to see on Sunday compared to what people are going to see in NASCAR.
Yeah, it's tremendous. It can be as much as 50 miles an hour and an average lap at Indianapolis, where an Indy car is averaging 230 miles an hour, and a stock car might be doing 180 average speed. Right. They're lighter, they're more aerodynamic, they're lower to the ground, the whole thing. They're built for speed, and they are spectacular to watch. It's especially at Indianapolis, it's such a challenging course. It's so difficult, and To watch those cars go around there is just breathtaking. The one thing that we can't do on television that I wish we could, we can't show you how hard the driver really is working in the car. It's just not possible. You know, the steering wheel doesn't move that much. You can't see the G-forces. You can't see, the feeling of the car slipping underneath the driver as he goes through that corner at 230 miles an hour. These guys are white-knuckling and working so hard to get around this racetrack. And that's the one disappointing thing from television, that we just, you know, we scratch our heads and wish we could find a way to make you feel what that's like, because it would scare the daylights out of you.
Yeah, and I know you had cameras in the car, and you showed the three of you commented several times Sunday evening about, look, he's barely moving the wheel, and they're going into turns. I mean, like they're touching the wheel.
Yeah, and again, that car is slipping underneath him, and he's right. Like, you know, don't crash, but he's not taking his foot off the floorboard either.
Right, exactly. All right, essentially, in the world of racing, this is a Super Bowl. So what are you going to do besides playing crooked stick and Brickyard Crossing? You do a lot of hard work to get this done. So what is the prep now leading up to it? And then obviously you're going to have to react to what you see. But what is your prep like so that you're ready for all 33 drivers?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, our team has been working on this for months. The technical planning, the feature shoots, I was in Indianapolis in February, and we did a whole, we interviewed every driver that's in IndyCar racing. We sat them down in a studio in Indianapolis, and we interviewed them about the race and about preparing for the race. And we interviewed them on tape. We've done all kinds of things. We've been here for 2 weeks now. Between the road course race, the Grand Prix, the week of practice, the qualifying this past weekend, we've talked to so many people and followed the story as it goes. It's accumulated knowledge. It's like, you know, what you know about the Nittany Lions football team on opening day versus what you know on Thanksgiving weekend. Right. A great deal of that is accumulated knowledge across that period of time. But it's the same thing with us. And so now we take all that accumulated knowledge, we stick it in the back of our brain, and we watch the race unfold, and we react. There's no script to this, just like with a ball game. So we take that accumulated knowledge, and we react to the situations as they unfold. We hope we've prepared for every possible situation, including the best and worst that could happen in a race. And you read and react, and tell the story from there. We got 100 cameras for the 100th Indy 500. Ooh. I hope we've got it all covered.
Yeah, I would think so. It is maybe the most famous 2.5 mile stretch in the world, and people have watched. I think it's the 52nd, 53rd straight year ABC is going to have this. But in reality, as someone who's been around there, what is the personality of this track? Every track has its own personality. So, what's the personality of this track beyond the fact that it's Indianapolis that makes it a difficult test for a driver?
It is moody, where the weather and the temperature and winds are concerned and how the cars react to those at the speeds they're traveling. It's difficult to forecast. And the price you pay for making a mistake is extreme. There are no easy crashes at Indianapolis. And so everything is so required to be exacting to have a chance to win the race. The engineering has to be proper. The decisions the strategists make have to be correct and on the money. The driver cannot take a chance and make a wrong move. When you're going down a backstretch at 230 miles an hour and you're getting a draft on the guy in front of you and you have to make a decision whether you'll be able to clear him before turn three, and if not, does he see you and is he going to give way, or are you going to bang wheels and have a disastrous crash? And they're going to do that four corners, 200 laps. It's very unforgiving, and the price for a mistake is very heavy, and that's the mood, if you will, of Indianapolis.
One final question, I'll let you go because I know you've other things you have to take care of, and that is this: what did it mean to you a couple of years ago when the door opened for this particular lead assignment with the Indianapolis 500, and then transitioned to what it means to call the 100th running of it?
Well, this is you know, in our business, you want to be on the big shows. You want to be on the big events. You know, if you're going to do a football game, wouldn't you love the chance to do, you know, the college football national championship? For me, this is one of the biggest events in the world and the biggest event in motorsports, which I've spent a lot of my career calling. It comes with a great deal of responsibility. I take the responsibility to the history of the event, the audience that it brings, and all that it means very, very seriously. And at the same time, it's a thrill because I'm a huge fan of the event. And I've got the best seat in the house, and I'm surrounded by a couple of hundred of the best, most talented broadcasting people you can imagine. And I stand where my heroes and my idols in the broadcasting business stood before, like Jim McKay and so on. So what it meant to me was disbelief. Really? You're asking me to do this? And at the same time, immense satisfaction and responsibility. I got the best job in the world. That's what it is.
Alan, tremendous respect for your work. I know it'll be a great call on Sunday. We wish you nothing but the best, and thanks a lot for the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure, and I hope our paths cross in football season.
I hope so, too. I didn't get a chance to say hi to you down in Jacksonville. I think we're on different levels of the press box, so I apologize for that.
I think you guys were on about 20 hours a day is what it was.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alan. All the best to you. Great call on Sunday.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Alan Bestwick, ABC Sports. He does a great job. He really does. And he will get the call for the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500. Now, it's not the 100th year. The first one won by Ray Haroon was back in 1911. But during World War II, they didn't run the Indy 500. Let's face it, when you had gas rationing, it was not great image-wise to run a car race during World War II. So they missed those years. So this is the 100th running of it coming up on Sunday. Well, I just want to ask you something, Sean. Do you think the suit was happy with that?
I would think so. Absolutely. He's got nothing to complain about.
Well, no, I mean, we need some text here. Is there some text? This was his baby.
He'll have this complete interview transcribed and posted. Won't you, Kevin? Good to see you, Kevin. He just turned the corner.
Well, I only have three words for him. Go sell something. We'll come back with more in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Our thanks to Alan Bestwick, who has the privilege of announcing the Indianapolis 500. Look, we want to take you to not only great local events, but we also want to take you to the big events. And that's why last week we had Dick Girardi on before the Preakness. Why we have Alan Bestwick on before the Indianapolis 500. Why we're going to the U.S. Open. There's no such thing as we're just in Sunbury. We're just in the Valley. No, you can go anywhere from here. And we try to take you as many places as possible. I mean, we've had, we had guests on, for goodness sakes, in Sochi from the Olympics. We've had Patrick McEnroe on from the Australian Open down in Melbourne. And so we've tried to take you as many places as possible on the show, because there is no such thing as being, well, we're just in the Valley. We're just in Sunbury. No, it's a gateway to the world. We can go anywhere. We got a phone, don't we? And so that's what we try to do. And the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500 is a huge event. I mean, for auto racing, Sunday's the day. With Monaco in the morning, Indy 500 afternoon, and then down to Charlotte for the big 600-mile NASCAR race on Sunday night. It's all about racing on Sunday on Memorial Day weekend.
Kevin has given me his itinerary for Sunday. I mean, he has the lawn mowing, the cookout, in strategic spots so he doesn't miss a lap of any of those.
Okay, I just want to let you know that I've invested in Fellows. You know what Fellows is?
Yes.
Makers of great shredders. So why don't you just shred that thing, because nobody cares. He's in the back right now. I hate that guy! We're the Sunbury Motors Studio. 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Key, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. John Solomon on college football next half hour.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
As the suit pulls out of the parking lot, we would like to tell everybody that we're brought to you by our good friends at Sunbury Motors. 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, K Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Oh, stop laughing, Sean. Because you know darn well he's sitting in the car right now, and he can't believe I said that.
No, I was going to check to see what he, I wanted to get his thoughts on the Bestwick interview, and it's like he's going down the road. He gone.
Oh, you know. Well, day's done. You know.
Good gig if you can get it.
I mean, you don't mind if the rest of us go out here and throw some heavy innings, do you? Give the bullpen a break tonight. 6:35 the airtime tonight. Phillies and the Tigers here on WKOK. Jeremy Hellickson tonight against Justin Verlander. 7:10 the first pitch this evening with Scott and L.A., and that will be this evening here. WKOK, and then they're in this time slot tomorrow because the game at Comerica is an afternoon game. And then we'll be back on Thursday with Doug Gottlieb. Our thanks to Alan Bestwick, previous half hour. John Solomon from CBSSports.com about to join us in a few moments. Sports bozo of the day. It's the wrong terminology for this. I mean, in terms of, but the Baylor situation is ultra serious, and it's not a quote bozo crazy situation, but it is this how serious this is beyond words, and if there's one sexual assault anywhere, that's one too many, and it's an issue that has been discussed extensively about college campuses the last 5 years, where it's been brought up extensively, or even the NCAA has brought it up. And now you have this situation there. Remember, Baylor had one other ultra serious situation where one player murdered another in basketball, and Dave Bliss lost his job over it, and they brought in this group to clean up after that group. That's what makes it even more serious. But it's still unfolding. I don't have enough information to really make a call one way or the other as to what's going on there. I don't know all the ins and outs. Now, maybe John Solomon does. And John Solomon now joins us from CBSSports.com. He's their lead college football writer. John, welcome. Great to have you with us. How difficult has it been for you to navigate the Baylor story?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it I'm following advice from outstanding reporting by some other people on who have been digging into it for a while now. It's people at Texas Monthly, like Jessica Luther, Paula Levine, and Mark Schlabel at ESPN. Paula's really done a bulk of the work, and she's done some really fine work. It's just been a really disturbing story, you know, to see. And I think, you know, everyone understands to an extent that there is going to be behavioral issues with young people on campus. That's understood. Football players, athletes, non-athletes, that happens. You don't want it to happen. You have to take precautions against it. But then the big issue here is then how the adults, how the coaches or the administrators, the university as a whole, reacts to the allegations. What are their actions? What do they do? What do they not do? In this case, it appears to be a lot of what they didn't do, a lot of inaction. that just has so many people upset. And even to this day, as they've investigated it, Baylor just still could not tell a lot of these rape victims and students and concerned alumni whether they're going to release the report that their law firm has put together to figure out sort of what happened. And so there's just been a whole lot of words by Baylor and not much transparency. And until now, assuming the report is accurate, with Ken Starr being out as chancellor, not a whole lot of accountability.
Is it more difficult to cover a private school in terms of trying to get information as opposed to a public school?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, and some public schools can be difficult as well, just depending on what their state open record laws are. But no doubt a private university is extremely difficult because they're private and they're not bound by the public record laws in order to get some of that information. In this case with Baylor, it also was appeared to be the Waco Police Department not having some of these police reports and details public, and it's not really clear why some of these reports weren't public. And so that's part of the equation too. And then also there is a new law in Texas that requires police departments, even at private universities, campus police departments, to produce some public information regarding some of these reports, and the Texas Attorney General just came back with an opinion on this last week saying that Baylor is going to have to turn over some information, not necessarily all, but some from other police reports, other requests that have been made by media outlets. So I suspect we're going to see more stories about Baylor in the future.
2 weeks ago today, you put out a story about Penn State. It's my understanding, I talked to James Franklin, you actually had done a lot of legwork on the story before then. More stuff had been released. In the end, what were some things, some themes in that story that struck you about Penn State and the future of it with James Franklin in charge?
Yeah, it really was a story going into it, just sort of looking at the state of the program and the state of where they are post-Paterno, and with that still that divide and that give and take and that pull between different supporters of the program about how to honor his legacy. And a lot of the reporting came before the additional information then came out that we saw in those court cases. So they had to sort of adapt a little bit on the fly. But what stood out to me just in the reporting was even before those latest accusations came out from the court case, there is just still this divide about how to honor him. And I really wonder if Penn State is going to be able to be as good as it can be, you know, as a university as a whole, and it's still a fine, tremendous university, and also as a football program. Can it be as good as it can be without getting past this? I mean, at some point, I just wonder if this is going to take decades as opposed to, you know, just five or so years before they could really unite again. I've seen this in some other universities. I used to be a Clemson beat reporter, and I covered them around 1999 to 2005, and there was still the remnants of the ouster of Danny Ford as the football coach, and that was 1990.
Right.
I grew up in the Maryland area when Len Bias died, and the aftermath of that, and that took a decade or so. And these things can really linger.
What strikes you about James Franklin that would let you say, you know what, he has the ability to make this happen?
Well, I don't know. I don't know one way or another yet.
Okay.
On James Franklin. I think the jury's still out a little bit. I think it still seems like from some fans that the jury is still out. He has brought in some pretty good recruiting classes based on rankings. Saquon Barkley certainly has turned into a really fine player.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is fair to say that I don't think many football programs across the country would have done a whole lot better than what Penn State's done the past couple of years, given the sanctions, given how negative the exposure has been to the program because of what happened with Sandusky, and to still go to a couple bowl games and still win, you know, seven games or so. It shows it didn't collapse. You know, the program didn't collapse. But having said that, you still need the coach and the fan base on the same page. And I'm not sure if that's ultimately going to be the case, but, you know, we'll see.
You also have to deal with the element of money. And the Big Ten, including Penn State, appears to be on the doorstep of them reaping a lot of money. The Sports Business Journal reported the possibility of a contract with Fox just for one tier of the rights. What kind of separation is is being created between the SEC, the Big Ten, and the other Power Five conferences based on contracts.
It's a pretty big gap. I mean, even just looking at last year, before this new Big Ten deal, and when the SEC network deal first kicked in and got some tax return forms from 2014-15, and the Big 12 payout was about, per school, was about $10 million less than the SEC. The Pac-12 payout was about $8 million less. The Big Ten was already ahead, not five that amount, but they're going to continue to go ahead because they've got the Big Ten network, because of this new revenue. And this really has been a trend you've been seeing happening here for a couple years now, and that is you've got a new tier, and it's the Big Ten SEC up at 1A, 1B, however you label them. Then the other three Power Five, Big 12, ACC, Pac-12, and then the rest of FBS. That doesn't in and of itself mean that the other major conferences can't compete for national titles. I don't think that's necessarily the case. Clemson was really close to winning the national championship last year. You can have all the money in the world and still not know how to use it or still hire the wrong people. You know, look at Texas for the longest period of time. But it does give you built-in advantages to really help you on some of those areas.
John, we just went through the NFL draft. There are several players that went undrafted. The NBA has modified its system in terms of how long you can stay in the evaluation period before deciding whether or not to go back. Some guys have hired agents like Diamond Stone and so forth. What should the pro leagues, what should they do to adapt to the college game that gives players better evaluations on staying or going?
Well, I think one thing, at least for college football, is giving the players more time to make their decisions and get the information. Look, at least what the NBA and the NCAA has done with college basketball is given them some more time. They've been able to go through some of the combines, work out individually for teams, and then the players get a better idea, a better picture. Okay, where do I really stand? And then you make the call, you know, at that point, one way or another. But for the NFL, you're looking at an NFL draft deadline for underclassmen around, like, January 18th or so, right, a week after the national championship game,
right,
before the NFL combine, before individual workouts, pro days, all of that. And I don't think it's very fair to the players. I wrote a column this a couple weeks ago. I'm of the opinion, I think the NCAA should let undrafted underclassmen in football and basketball back in. If they want to come back, I don't see the harm in letting them come back.
Is one of the issues, of course, is that in college basketball, you have an early signing period. Now, Spike Albrecht got caught up in this, and then eventually he had to transfer to Purdue. But in college football, the signing date is, what, 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks after the declaration date. How would you adapt that if you're going to give players more time to decide whether they're staying or going?
Yeah, no doubt that would be a challenge. It's something you'd have to work through. Not saying it's a perfect scenario, but
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on this.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how can this be massaged to make it work?
Right. Well, I mean, we do see attrition anyway right now in college football, right, during spring.
That's right.
In the summer sometimes. We see players coming and going. They're deciding to transfer. Maybe they've been kicked out. Scholarships get added, maybe the walk-ons. We see graduate transfers. They have to finish up their college work at their old school in order to go to somewhere else and graduate. So it's not like attrition isn't happening right now. I just think you have to start with the premise, at least first, of, okay, we do believe that we should give these players more time or the ability to come back to school. And if you start with that premise, then you figure out the details. But what happens a lot of times in college sports, and it's understandable to an extent because coaches are based on winnings, wins, and losses, and that's why they're fired and hired. But the players are viewed as assets. You know, they're viewed as, to your point, you're right. Oh no, we don't know how many players we're able to sign right now because these players are maybe leaving or maybe coming back. And that's a real issue. Mm-hmm. But it's also an issue because they're viewed as assets to the program, and, you know, and property in a sense. And so if you view it differently and view it as what we are always told, this is the mission of college sports, view it educationally, okay, why not allow the players to come back if they're undrafted? And that gives them a carrot to continue to work towards graduation by continuing to play, assuming that they want to come back, assuming they're academically eligible, and maybe have some other conditions in there. But I think it's something to explore.
I think the other part, too, is I don't think a lot of people realize probably 70% of the programs are not at 85 anyway.
Absolutely.
So, and that's a lot. Something a lot of people don't read. I think they hear the number 85. They assume everybody's at 85. Most schools are at 81, 82, somewhere in that neighborhood anyway. I want to get back to the Baylor thing for a moment. You wrote a column, very thoughtful column. Baylor, quote, of all schools should know actions matter more than words. Now, obviously, it's a different regime at a different time, but it's not as if they, as a school, as a university, they haven't gone through this before. Is it disturbing that it appears on the surface they didn't learn anything?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Baylor, of all schools,
yep,
given what they went through in 03, should know this. And when we talk NCAA scandals, to me, Baylor and Dave Bliss is like up at the top of all time. I mean, when you have a basketball coach who decides to disparage with false allegations against a deceased basketball player murdered by another basketball player,
right,
in order for the coach to cover up his NCAA violations, like, that's about as bad as he can get. And that was only in 2003. I mean, not really that long ago, 13 years ago. And some of the people in position now were hired after that. They were hired to clean this up. And yet here we are with some of the same questions, about whether there's been cover-ups and whether they've been, forthcoming enough.
John, you have to cover a wide variety of stories. What stories do you like to write? What are the ones that, when you get that idea or get that assignment, you can't wait to attack it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I like digging into issue stories, such as Baylor or, okay, Penn State, or just, being able to dig into one topic and go deeper into it rather than just the, whatever the headlines are for page views or, whatever people are chattering about, trying to find out more information. I like a lot of the legal issues. I follow the O'Bannon case and a lot of the NCAA lawsuits quite a bit. But then just stories about programs and how they sort of evolve over time, such as the Penn State story was interesting.
Very, very interesting. I mean, no question about that. Now, what's also interesting is that this is supposed to be the slowest time of the year.
There's always stories.
When did it stop being this? When did college football, in your mind, stop being ever slow?
Yeah, you know what? There actually still can be slow times, and I think we've even seen some in recent weeks. I'm maybe writing about it here later this week about all the chatter about this college football commissioner idea.
Yeah.
To me, that's a sign of like how overexposed college football
right,
is, and that we have to talk about something here in May, April and May, and let's gin up sort of this idea about a college football commissioner. That, well, I think there's some decent ideas associated with it. I just don't see how practically it would ever happen.
Where do you think college football is now, in your opinion, in terms of popularity, how it's run, and where can it improve?
Well, it's incredibly popular. I mean, you just look at the media rights deals. You look at some of the TV ratings. Now, the cord cutting is happening with cable, so that's becoming an issue for media rights, at least for some conferences. You'd like college football to be a little bit wiser in terms of when they play their semifinal games, and not just bow to what a couple bowl games and conferences won. It just makes no sense to me to play those on New Year's Eve, and then you have the Rose Bowl or some other games that are, decent games. But January 1st should be your biggest games, outside the national championship. 10 days later, or whatever. January 1st should always be the semifinals.
Yeah, we were at the Tax Slayer Bowl, so our group, Jack Ham, myself, we were sitting there on New Year's Eve, and we're looking at each other like, this makes no sense. It makes no sense. The next day, it's like, okay, fine, it's New Year's Day, but New Year's Eve made no sense. Okay. Hey, John, absolute pleasure. Very enlightening, and really enjoy reading your stuff. You really get in depth with some things, and you attack a lot of stuff.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
John Solomon from CBSSports.com. We'll come back, wrap it up in a moment. Today's show brought to you by our good friends at Sunbury Motors. 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, key routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Subaru Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you, the other guy's way or the SMC way. The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years. Great to have you with us. Wrapping things up for today, as really only we can do it. I didn't say that was good or bad. We're off tomorrow. We've got the Phillies and the Tigers tonight at Comerica. Jeremy Hellickson tonight for the Phils and Justin Verlander for the Tigers. 6:35 the airtime with Scott Fransky and Larry Anderson. 7:10, the first pitch tonight. Then the Tigers and the Phillies will play tomorrow. By the way, Justin Upton not in the Tiger lineup tonight. Michael Vilas will start in left field for him. And then we have the Phillies and Tigers tomorrow. This no-show tomorrow. We'll be back on Thursday. And when we do come back, it's going to be Doug Gottlieb from CBS who will join us on the show. So we're looking forward to that very much. So it's been a pretty, and look, next week, by the way, we have Coaches versus Cancer coming up here. The tournament's going to be here. Special Olympics is here next week. A lot going on. A lot going on. Memorial Day weekend. Sean, it was really kind of an awful scene. He screamed out, look, if the suit has the day off, so do I. I mean, I didn't quite understand what that meant. I don't know, it seemed kind of competitive to me. But
I'm just trying to keep up.
I mean, he's off now,
right?
I mean, I received a text from him, by the way, and the text was, "I'm actually going to see a business. Really, I am. Seriously, I am. I am." And I knew it was from him because a couple of words weren't spelled right. So it's. Our thanks to Alan Bestwick for being on the show today. Check it out on the Steve Jones Show podcast. Our thanks to John Solomon. We talked Indianapolis 500, and we talked about a wide range of issues around college football with John Solomon. Off day tomorrow because of the Phillies and Tigers, who, by the way, are on tonight at 6:35 here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Back on Thursday with Doug Gottlieb from CBS Sports. And we're working on getting Ryan Snyder on the show as well. Wraps it up from here for Sean Carey and, in the background, the suit.
We're your home for news, sports, weather, and your home for the Phillies. News Radio 1070 WKOK, Sunbury.